Coming up on Heard on the Street, why Goldman failed its best subject and taking the IPO magic out of Silicon Valley's unicorns.
Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Hello and welcome to Heard on the Street, the podcast. We are the Wall Street Journal's home for commentary on all things financial all over the world. Reporting from New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried, joined by my colleague Alex Frangos in London. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Miriam.
So in our second segment, we'll talk about the upcoming Cloudera IPO and what it says about the fate of Silicon Valley's unicorns. But first, we have Heard on the Street's Aaron Back here to talk to us about this week's bank earnings. Hi, Aaron.
Hello, Miriam.
So, Aaron, the banks did pretty well this quarter with one notable exception, Goldman Sachs. What went wrong there?
Yeah, so it was a pretty good quarter for the biggest banks in the U.S. generally. Goldman Sachs really stood out, though, for missing estimates. And they seem to have not done a very good job with their trading book. And this is surprising because fixed income trading is, you know, supposedly one of their strongest areas, one of their strongest franchises at Goldman Sachs. Everybody else had like double-digit gains in fixed income trading revenue in the first quarter. And Goldman was basically flat. It was a real head scratcher.
And, so what do you think is going on? I mean, are they hiding something? Did they make a really bad trade?
So, publicly, they talked a bit about how they have a bigger commodities trading operation than everybody else. So the line on their statements is actually fixed income currencies and commodities, or as we call it, FIC in the industry. It's usually mostly dominated by fixed income and currencies, but Goldman is somewhat unique because they have a big commodities trading operation, bigger than the rest. And so they said that there was like exceptionally low volatility in oil markets in the first quarter, and that was, you know, part of the reason. But the next day, Morgan Stanley, who, you know, granted has a smaller commodities book, but they said actually commodities was fine for us. And, you know, Morgan Stanley had a very good trading quarter. So Goldman also kind of acknowledged on an analyst conference call that they, you know, quote unquote, could have done a better job navigating the market in the first quarter. So that suggests that, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was one bad trade, but it suggests that, you know, somewhere in the quarter they got flat footed and their traders were positioned for things to go one way and they, you know, it just didn't work out.
So, Aaron, what caused the good results at the other banks? What were the highlights and the bright spots at other banks?
Trading revenues have been kind of going up for the last few quarters. There's been an uptick in activity basically since Brexit in the markets because there's been so much sort of political events and market moves. Also banks are benefiting from higher interest rates, with respect to the banks that do more lending like JP Morgan. So it was a broadly positive quarter for the banks.
I mean, other than Goldman's stumble, which everyone loves to poke fun at, especially it sounds like Morgan Stanley, since they're their main rivals. I mean, you lay out that there's a kind of a virtuous storyline here for banks and investing in banks for the first time in a long time. Like, what looks good in the future for banks?
Yeah. So, I mean, precisely like, okay, everyone likes to kind of make fun of Goldman when they stumble because they, you know, are like often seen as the best bank on the street. So, you know, but I mean, actually their trading revenue was only just flat while others were up. It was not a disaster for Goldman. And my argument that I made in a recent column is that actually, you know, these banks all look a lot safer than they did just a few years ago. They have a lot of capital, arguably more capital than they need. And the Trump administration seems likely to allow them to return more of that capital to shareholders, which means more buybacks and more dividends.
More important that Goldman has some of its ex-executives in the Trump administration than manning the trading floor.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it really matters so much whether it's Goldman's people or Morgan Stanley's people or whatever.
But industry-friendly people.
Yeah, like there's an industry-friendly tone coming from the White House. And so, you know, perhaps the banks will be allowed to return more capital. Perhaps as I say in the piece, merely the process of determining how much capital they return can be streamlined, which itself would be very positive for the banks.
Is there any kind of a timeline for when that might start to happen, when we might start to see real financial regulation reform?
The administration has yet to have all its key regulatory appointments even nominated, let alone in place. Most glaringly is the head of the Federal Reserve, chair of supervision. But there are others who need to be in place before they can kind of get their ducks in a row. But I think what really matters is the Federal Reserve's stress test process. This year's stress test is already going on. So it'll really be next year's stress test process, which will determine how much capital the banks can pay to shareholders in dividends and buybacks starting next year. So that's when I think we're really going to see possible benefits for the banks coming through.
And of all the big banks, like which ones have the excess capital? Like, who do I want to, if this is my trading thesis, who do I want to own?
Morgan Stanley has very high capital ratios. Basically, the regulator has been cautious in how much they've allowed them to return, but in the meantime, they've been having decent results. And Citigroup also looks quite overcapitalized at the moment. So those two banks have the biggest, I think, upside potential from capital returns. But the truth is, it'll be good for all the banks. I mean, it's a very simple thing. Like, if they are allowed to raise their dividends, then shareholders are going to get paid.
In the meantime, Aaron, do you expect them to continue to report strong results like we saw generally this quarter?
I mean, you never really know with respect to the trading book. You know, it comes, it goes. Market activity picks up, it falls off. We've got, now several elections in Europe. We've got the UK election. We've got the French election. That could move markets one way or the other. So I don't really know about the trading book. But I think that, I still expect interest rates to keep moving higher. And that'll be kind of broadly supportive for the group.
Thanks, Aaron. We are going to have to take a break. Coming up, why Cloudera's upcoming IPO could cloud the picture for its fellow unicorns.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
For more insights, enable the Wall Street Journal skill on any device with Amazon Alexa. Get all of our podcasts, as well as the latest news and market updates. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Welcome back to Heard on the Street, the podcast. I'm Miriam Gottfried here with Alex Frangos and Dan Gallagher, who joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Dan.
How's it going?
It's going all right. So, Dan, what the heck is Cloudera, and why are tech investors watching its IPO so closely?
Well, it's Cloudera is there. What they do is like kind of big data mining for services for businesses, cloud-based software. So they've what they are in terms of like IPO investors, though, is they're going to be the next so-called unicorn to try to go public. They're set to price next week. And they have a valuation. I mean, their private valuation was last around something like $4 billion. So they were kind of, I think, in the upper class of these so-called unicorns, which refer to companies that are valued at more than a billion.
And Dan, do we expect their IPO to go smoothly without a hitch and bring in big profits for investors?
Well, it may have a better chance of that now, because what they did is the pricing terms they set were, pretty well below what their last private valuation was. The price terms contemplate valuation maybe in the $2 billion range, depending on if some exactly how many shares end up in there. But their last one, like I said, was about $4 billion. And that's something I've kind of been trying to watch, because this class of private companies that are so richly valued has grown quite substantially over the last 2 years, And the problem with, you know, packing, you know, private investors keep packing money into these companies, the valuations get larger. And then when the companies do decide either if they're going to try to go public or sell themselves, they have to hit this much higher target to make their investors money. And I think for a lot of cases, that's just not going to happen. And this is, like, I think the most explicit example that we've seen so far of this, of just having to kind of really come down from that private number.
So, Dan, what's the dynamic with the existing investors? I mean, generally you have a IPO and the, you know, the venture capital folks, you know, sell into it, try to get out. But if you were in the later rounds of Cloudera, are you, you know, are you in the money here? Are you breaking even? So are you going to stick around and hope that the stock goes up? I mean, what does this mean for them?
I they had quite a few rounds, so I'm not sure, like, at which value each one got into. I suspect the later investors are probably not going to make what they thought. Intel was actually a big investor in this company, and I've seen some stories where it's been referred to that they're going to take a loss. I don't know. I mean, the problem is a lot of the more practiced venture cap investors are pretty sophisticated and know how to strike the kind of deals where they tend to come out anyway, even if the headline numbers don't make it appear like they're going to.
Right.
When I write, I try to talk to the public investors who are evaluating these companies coming into the market. And I think public investors need to be really cautious about essentially writing checks to cash out these huge valuations that happened. And I think that's what you're seeing as they were hitting their early roadshows or talking to investors. I think they started to realize, you know, we're not going to get that kind of number. We got to come down.
Generally, when you have a big pipeline of companies that are, you know, looking to IPO, you maybe get the cream of the crop first. But, you know, here we have another company that doesn't make money. Is there anyone in the pipeline who, like, if you're a public market investor, like most of us here, that you wish you could own but that you can't? I mean, are there any of those around the corner, or are they, you know, happy, you know, all kind of, if they're doing well, then they're happy to not be public? What's your sense of the dynamic?
The actual pipeline, no. I mean, it's still pretty small. And the tech companies that have gone out so far this year, none of them are profitable. And I think we'll probably the rarity of a tech company who's kind of pursued a growth at any cost strategy that's going to be profitable once they hit the IPO stage is, I mean, few hit that before, and I think few are going to hit that now. So I think investors might, there's still ways investors can play on those companies. There's some companies that, you know, have promising prospects, even if they're currently losing money. And there's companies like Snapchat where the long-term value is still really questionable in my mind. But, you know, I'm not aware of companies that are, like, in the near-term pipeline that just have incredible earnings, at least from the tech side.
So, Dan, what does it say about all these companies that are, you know, not public, all the unicorns, and the reality that really underpins their valuation? I mean, are they really worth that much if investors can't sell their stakes in it for that much?
Well, I mean, you're worth what you can get for it. So if they can keep raising money and continue like they have been, a lot of them will probably try to do that. But I think they're getting... I think there's a point coming in which that money starts to slow down and these companies, you know, have to decide, okay, we're going to finally go public, or is there somebody out there that's interested in buying us? I mean, the commonality with all these companies is they need an extra strategy of some kind, the investors that put this kind of money in. So there's reckoning to be sure. And because of the number of people with these huge companies with these big valuations has gotten so large, yeah, I don't think we've seen the worst part of what could be a lot of damaging, essentially public down rounds yet.
I also wonder, what does this mean for, you know, the future of public tech companies? You know, we have, you know, the old line of tech companies that are tremendously profitable, and then we have a few somewhat newer ones that are very profitable, like Facebook. But, I mean, does the future of tech just mean these, you know, massive unprofitable companies?
Well, I think a lot of tech companies, I mean, that's not a new thing. You know, it's often an expensive business to start with. So, no, I don't think investors are going to stop chasing tech opportunities. I think long term, you know, if we get out, you know, 5-6 years from now and we kind of see, you know, how this is shaken out, We may go back to where the private valuations don't go up so incredibly high before you get to this kind of event. You know, there might be some more caution around that point. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that, you know, starting a tech company is often a very expensive prospect. You're going to be losing money for a while. I don't think those dynamics really change. I think just the, you know, there'll be some ebb and flow between, you know, where people try to make their money at. You know, in 2000, we saw a lot of people trying to make their money on the public side when they went IPO and you had these huge pops. And I think what we do now is kind of a reaction to that, as people try to get in on the private side earlier on.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on the future of Silicon Valley's unicorns.
Need to get up to speed on top stories? Subscribe to WSJ Minute Briefing for updates from the Wall Street Journal. WSJ Minute Briefing. Make it a part of your flash briefing on the Amazon Echo and other Alexa devices. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
So, Dan, do you think that this year we will see actual profits from some of these companies that have gone public recently? And I'm talking about Okta, MuleSoft, Snap, or next week, Cloudera. Do you think in the next year we'll see actual profits from any of these companies?
I don't really know. I don't think so, because the pattern I've seen with companies in this kind of space is they tend to lose for a couple years at least before they start to get there. They may surprise on that for all we see. And of course, there's Snapchat, which has this huge growth rate but loses a lot of money too. And you know, I got a feeling profitability there might be a couple years away still. So, but I don't know. I mean, these companies could certainly surprise, and they'll probably also be responsive to how the stocks actually fare in the market after they've been out a while, because you know, they need long term. You need to have a stock that has value. If it's going to have value as an employee compensation and all those other bells and whistles. And so you need a healthy stock price. So you need to run the business in a way that public investors want to see.
So if public investors don't need profits, then you don't need them either.
Well, yeah. I mean, we could argue about, you know, how much do tech investors really value profits, because there's a lot of companies whose stocks do very well, even when the profits get, you know, sometimes thin or non-existent. I mean, Amazon, we've seen that go back and forth over years. So I don't think tech investors are all of a sudden going to switch to saying, okay, it's profits or nothing kind of approach. But I think as we get to, you know, there's a flight to quality, especially in certain times in the market where it favors companies that are financially healthier.
We are going to have to end it there. That wraps things up for this week's Heard on the Street podcast. Please join us every week for the latest in global investing. For more, please check us out at wsj.com/heard. That's wsj.com/heard. You can also email us with your comments, suggestions, or questions at heardpodcast@wsj.com. From New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried. On behalf of the rest of the Heard on the Street team, thanks for listening.
The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.